We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. At one time, judges had broad discretion in sentencing. All that, however, changed in the 70s and 80s as state commissions and the federal government created binding sentencing guidelines. Now, some people said that was good, and it was a sign that we're really getting serious about pursuing criminals. However, other people have argued that the result has been a sentencing process that is both costly and unjust. In this part of Focus 580, we'll try and take a look at some of the many and sometimes surprising ways that sentencing policy works to determine who ends up in prison and for how long. And our guest for the program is Douglas Berman. He's professor of law at The Ohio State University. A main focus of his teaching and research is criminal law and criminal sentencing. He's the co-author of the casebook Sentencing Law and Policy, Cases, Statutes, and Guidelines, and has also written on many topics, including capital punishment and also federal sentencing guidelines. He served as the editor of the Federal Sentencing Reporter for more than a decade. He also now serves as co-managing editor of the Ohio State Journal of Criminal Law. He is also the creator and author of a widely read and widely cited blog, Sentencing Law and Policy, which, in fact, has the distinction of being the first blog ever cited by the U.S. Supreme Court. As we talk this morning, he's joining us by phone. As we talk this morning, of course, comments, questions from listeners are welcome. We just ask that the people try to be on the topic for us and also try to be brief so we can get as many callers as possible into the program. But certainly, questions are welcome from listeners. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you might be listening. And if it would be a long-distance call, we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are certainly welcome. Professor Berman, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And how are you?
Very well, very
good.
Well.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for your focus on this important topic.
Well, I think that it's interesting, and I hope we can have this conversation in a way that it's going to be accessible to all of those people who are listening this morning who are not law professors, and I certainly am not. So I'm coming at it at a very elemental level.
I try to be as elemental as possible, even for my students, because some of these issues do get very complicated, but I think I always find them interesting because there are some very basic issues at the core, and they present very basic but I think very challenging questions for how American society wants to deal with crime and public safety.
Sure. Well, I think as a way of starting, I think this point is true, and that is, it seems that when we look at criminal justice, we talk a lot about what happens when people are charged and when they're tried. So what happens in everything leading up to the verdict. But we don't really seem to talk very much about, there's not much focus on what happens if and when a person is found guilty.
I think that's right, although that has been, as your introduction at the beginning highlighted, changing over the last few decades. Definitely sentencing has become a much greater focal point of the entire criminal justice system, and that's reflected both in laws passed by legislatures at the state and federal level and also in the work of the Supreme Court, where they're taking on more and more sentencing cases over time. It's certainly good for my business, as I like to say, but I think that reflects a couple factors. One is certainly the guilt-innocence stage, sort of the starting, who gets prosecuted, whether they get convicted, has a lot more drama. And in some sense, we like to believe, has more black and white answers, right? You know, the person's guilty or not guilty. The person should be subject to the criminal justice system or shouldn't. And we often will debate those issues and have robust debates. When you get to sentencing, there's a lot more nuance involved. And I think to some extent, that's part of the problem, is it's hard to feel comfortable or confident that you ever come up with the right answer, because these are often judgment calls. And that itself explains why, over time, legislatures have been worried about disparity, having created these sentencing guideline systems you mentioned before, because it's dangerously easy for two different judges trying their best to have two very different views about what would be the right sentencing outcome once it's established that a particular offender has or is found guilty of a particular crime.
Well, maybe you could talk a little bit more about what's happened here when we go to a point where, and I think that there certainly, as you say, there was a point where there was this feeling that perhaps judges had too much discretion, or at least you could find too many examples where, to the extent that they were comparable, you had two comparable individuals, comparable crimes and charges, and getting very different sentences. So I suppose some people would say, you know, there was a time when it was just all, when it was way too loose.
Right.
And so in a way, an attempt to deal with that, then we have the federal government and we have states coming along and saying, okay, we're going to set up sentencing guidelines. And then I think some people looked at that and said, well, you know, maybe we've gone too far, we've swung too far the other way, that one of the things we expect judges to do is judge, and that in having mandatory sentencing, then we've taken that important job away from judges. So, you know, maybe you can talk about how it is where we were, where we are now, and, you know, have we really gone way too far from one direction and too far in the other direction?
Sure. Well, I think you've described the pendulum swings very, very well, and a point that I would emphasize is there have been underlying evolutions in our philosophy of not just crime but punishment especially, and during the era, really the first half of the 20th century, in which judges were given very broad discretion at sentencing, there was somewhat of an attitude that sentencing wasn't even something that should be controlled by law, that what we should be doing is more almost social work. Many people involved in the sentencing system, particularly probation officers, parole officials, and the like, weren't expected to have law degrees, were expected to have a background in human behavior or social abilities, in part because everybody at least formally subscribed to the philosophy that the goal at sentencing should be trying to rehabilitate the offender, the instinct being, and one that tends to be seen as more progressive, look, once we've decided this person is guilty of some crime, the goal for society should be to figure out how to fix the defendant. And in fact, this era was often described as sort of the medical model of sentencing, where you'd have judges and probation officers and parole officials and prison officials all invested in rehabilitation, how to fix the prisoner, and that's why, among other things, a lot of our labels, the Corrections Institute or the corrections officials, reflect that philosophy. The problem was, and it's a problem that transcends the players involved, first, we had a lot of faith in rehabilitation, but not a lot of evidence it was working. And especially in the 60s and 70s, as crime rates started to increase, as our own data showed that a lot of criminals were repeat offenders, there was a perhaps justifiably pessimistic attitude that rehabilitation, which had promised, we can fix every offender, was a misguided way to approach these issues, and particularly was dangerous for public safety. Combined that with, and this is where that was sort of the right's criticism of all of this discretion in the rehabilitation model, it just doesn't work. The left also chimed in, noticing that disproportionately correction officials and prosecutors and judges were white, sort of upper middle class individuals, and they would perceive the potential for rehabilitation to be much greater for criminals that looked like them or sounded like them. So white collar offenders were often given truly slaps on the wrist. The idea of a prison sentence, this is going back into the 50s and 60s, the idea of an actual prison term for a white-collar offender was largely unheard of. And again, the concern from the left was that there was reflected a kind of social and class bias, that judges thought because offenders look like them, they're more likely to be rehabilitated. And so those forces combined to lead to a number of commentators on both the left and the right saying we need to put rehabilitation behind other interests. Interests like deterrence, interests like incapacitation, and especially powerful this idea of retribution, that there was a notion of a just punishment for certain crimes, and that that just punishment could be and should be equal no matter what the nature of the offender. So that if you committed a certain crime, whether it's a violent crime or a drug crime or a sexual offense, there's a certain fixed sentence, maybe not exactly 5 years, but a narrow range, maybe 4 to 6 years, where everybody who's committed that crime ought to be placed, and these other factors like rehabilitation or the nature of the individual ought only be kind of marginal significance. And that became very much the philosophy that drove the development of sentencing guidelines that led federal and state legislatures, much more so than judges, because they were the ones noticing the social problems with the rehabilitative model, to impose these fairly rigid and fairly strict laws that essentially turned judges, this is how many judges at the time started to speak of it, into guideline calculators or mathematicians whose job it was to just add up points on a grid to figure out how serious the legislature or a sentencing commission had viewed the offense, and then to just impose whatever sentence this machine had printed out. And in fact, one of the early reformers suggested, this is back in the 60s and 70s, well, gee, these new computers are really working out. Maybe someday we could even aspire to have sentencing by computers. And wouldn't that be a great revelation, because a computer wouldn't be subject to the biases and prejudices that where there was a kind of heightened concern about under the old system. The problem, as your response highlights, is I'm not sure anybody would want to be sentenced by a computer.
Yeah.
You know, at the same time that we recognize that human judgment can be subject to these biases, we also recognize that human judgment is indispensable for doing justice and for balancing these sets of concerns. And so what tended to happen, as is probably true in a lot of settings, is, you know, the hot new philosophy takes over, takes hold, legislatures get drawn to that approach, and more often than not, they're relatively unaware, or at least less sensitive to the harms and extremes of taking that new idea too far. And that's what, particularly in the federal system, less so in some state systems where there was always a little bit more balance built into the system, but particularly in the federal system, the rigidity, the way in which judges were forced in applying the federal sentencing guidelines, which started out as a relatively big book of rules and has grown almost literally to be as large as the tax code, that seemed to be leeching the human judgment out of the sentencing experience. And then on top of that, and this has been sort of the last sort of modern pushback, when you do that kind of calculation, the interest in rehabilitation, the interest in helping to prepare an offender for reentering society has gotten not only lost but put so far behind other goals that we've come to discover that that is now disserving public safety and public interest. Our prison rates have increased dramatically, not only because we've imposed harsher sentences with these new rules, but because people have been released from prison without the kind of rehabilitative servicing and individuality that the old system had, and our recidivism rates have actually increased, notwithstanding our concern with doing more deterrence, with incapacitating individuals more. And in fact, the large percentage of people returning to prison are folks who have been on probation and parole, have not been able to get their life in order, and have then gone on to commit either a probation or parole violation or some other new offense. And so we're now at a time where not only, again, are there people saying, from kind of a philosophical perspective, limiting judges so dramatically may not achieve justice, but it also may not be effective and efficient for public safety, because those rehabilitative ideas that were at the foundation at the beginning need to remain part of the story if we're going to have the best chance to prevent offenders, once they're in the system, from going back into a criminal lifestyle rather than getting on with their lives and becoming law-abiding citizens.
Yeah. Let's just quickly to introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus 580, Douglas Berman. He's professor of law at The Ohio State University. His main teaching and research focuses in the area of criminal law and criminal sentencing, and has written a lot about that. And he is the author, creator of the blog, widely read blog, Sentencing Law and Policy, which has the distinction of being the first blog ever cited by the U.S. Supreme Court. And we're talking here about sentencing law, sentencing policy. Questions are welcome. 1-800-333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We can talk some more about some of these things, but I guess one thing I was interested in, maybe you can talk about a little bit more about this. I imagine some people, when they hear talking some discussion about mandatory sentencing, that they have this idea that says, well, okay, so now what judges have essentially is a book or something like this, where they look up the crime and they go to a certain page in the book and says, okay, you do this crime, here's your sentence. Well, at least I have looked at some material here about federal sentencing guidelines, and it may be, I'm sure it's true that the judges don't have the discretion that they used to, but that doesn't necessarily mean the process of figuring out what the sentence should be is simple. I mean, it does look to me, indeed, that there are a number of complications and that you're still looking at some aspects of the crime, of the individual, and so forth, and there is some calculation to the point where, as you said, maybe you would need a computer or a computer could do it. So it sounds as if to me that it's not really a simple, straightforward matter of coming up with a sentence.
Well, that's absolutely right, and again, here's where it keeps me in a job. There is, in some sense, every flavor and variation under the sun, depending on which sentencing guideline system you're looking at, state systems versus federal systems, which particular sentencing laws you're looking at. There are some federal sentencing laws passed by Congress that are very strict mandatory minimums that simply say, no doubt about it, no variation at all. For example, if you have a gun with you when you commit a gun crime, that's automatically 5 additional years onto your sentence. And in fact, if you do two offenses or 3 offenses, then it's another 25 years on top of that. And so there are some statutes, and again, you can imagine the rationale behind it. This will achieve deterrence. This will justly punish anybody who brings violence into a drug environment. And so there are some provisions in federal law that are that straightforward and rigid, although we could talk about how prosecutorial discretion will even bring nuances to those laws. But then, as you've noticed, there's a federal sentencing guidelines manual, which is this massive book that is actually not created by Congress directly, but there's a U.S. Sentencing Commission that writes those rules. And they aspire to be much more nuanced. And in fact, the Sentencing Commission has said, Congress, stop passing these crude, rigid, mandatory minimums, because that doesn't enable a judge to be attentive to different factors that may be involved in the offense. You could imagine, and this happens sometimes, it's a lot different whether you were to bring a gun to a drug event because you're a hunter and you're out not having the gun there for facilitating the drug deal, but you just happen to be out with your buddies hunting and somebody sells you a little bit of marijuana. That's a much different use of a gun in a drug transaction than if somebody's a violent drug dealer who's got a cachet of weapons with them every time they're going about doing their arrangement. And so what the federal sentencing guidelines do is try to bring those obviously relevant differences into the sentencing calculation. But the problem has been, and this is really, again, where sentencing gets so complicated, the more you try to do that, the more factors you try to put into the matrix, not only do you make it harder for everybody to even understand what the sentencing rules are, but the more mischief you can have in the way those rules get applied. So the most prominent example of this relates to the way drug sentences are calculated under the federal sentencing guidelines. There's a very elaborate set of formulas for how much drugs you have involved leading to what sentence. And again, the instinct makes perfect sense. I mean, everything in sentencing starts with good instincts. If you have more drugs involved, that's a more serious crime than if you have less drugs involved. But the problem has been, and this has led to different controversies, well, how do you decide which drugs should count for which amount? And in fact, what Congress did and what the Sentencing Commission did was make a little bit of crack cocaine lead to sentences that were the equivalent of 100 times as much powder cocaine. And that's been one of the most controversial stories, in part because you can convert powder cocaine to crack cocaine very easily. And what those rules have prompted is that the big dealers will only deal in powder, and they'll require the mules or the lower-level folks to convert it to crack. And so the rules inadvertently entail that the low-level dealers who are dealing in crack may be subject to much longer sentences under the big book than the high-level dealers dealing in powder, because they themselves are adjusting their behavior to try to work around the most severe rules, which, again, may have started with logic behind it. But as times change and as crime patterns change, there's been kind of a a challenge to updating these rules to make sure that they're always as effective as they need to be.
We have a caller here to bring in the conversation. Let's do that. Someone who is listening this morning in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, Professor. I sort of want to segue into your last comment about the 100-to-1 ratio between crack and powder cocaine.
Very well.
Isn't a major argument that this has a disparate impact on African-Americans in the sense that African-Americans disproportionately use crack cocaine, while Caucasian-Americans, generally of higher means, use the powder cocaine?
Yes, absolutely. That has been one of the points that's been emphasized by the U.S. Sentencing Commission. You know, to give a little bit of the history for folks not completely familiar with this controversial issue, back in 1986, spurred in part by the well-publicized death of Len Bias, a African-American basketball star at the University of Maryland who had just been drafted by the Boston Celtics, other deaths related to crack at the time, there was this talk of a crack epidemic. And the buzz in Congress was we need to get tough on this new drug that is more potent. And there was a lot of fear and discussion of crack babies and the like. And what Congress put into place was what was described as the 100-to-1 ratio, where under federal sentencing laws, crack offenses are treated at the same level of severity as somebody who has 100 times more powder cocaine. And the Sentencing Commission, to its credit, after studying the operation of these laws for a decade, said one of their many flaws, and they said there are many flaws with this ratio, is that disproportionately federal prosecutions of crack offenders are in the African-American community, and powder offenders are non-African-American, white, other races and backgrounds, and that whatever else we think of the sensibility of that ratio, and in fact the commission has said repeatedly, that ratio doesn't make sense even beyond the disparate racial impact, but this does have a profoundly negative effect in our effort to achieve equal justice. And as you may remember, David, one of the whole points of moving toward structured sentencing, having these rules in place, was to try to avoid both the reality and the perception of racial biases, class biases. And yet when these rules are constructed in ways that then as they get applied downstream impact communities in different ways, there are many people who have come to the conclusion, really myself included, that the kind of structural inequalities we have built into the system now are even more profound and problematic than some of the anecdotal evidence of bias that existed when we had a lot more discretion.
Thank you, Professor.
No, thank you. And that here, you know, one of the things that I wanted to come back to, and here I think you've provided one answer to the question. We were talking earlier about the move from judges having a lot of discretion to, and the problems that can be associated with that, to mandatory sentences, dealing with trying to make the system more fair. You said, well, in fact, you know, there are some harms associated with taking that, what might you might argue would be a good idea, taking that too far. It seems that this very thing that you're talking about here would, in fact, be one example.
Absolutely. And the other one that has been well documented and is the topic of some of my scholarship and a number of other scholars have highlighted is when you take the discretion away from judges at the sentencing stage, inevitably that discretion gets transferred, sort of like a balloon. That's the metaphor. You squeeze one part of the balloon and you get the air out there, it's just going to move to another part. And indisputably, the discretion has migrated towards prosecutors, and especially these mandatory minimum laws I was describing earlier. Prosecutors have discretion, and importantly, not only do they have the authority to do this, it's not reviewed by a court, it's not subject to really any public disclosure. Prosecutors can just choose of their own accord whether they will or won't add on one of these mandatory minimum laws when they're pursuing a case. So as I was describing the two cases before, in all likelihood, if prosecutors were going after the hunter who did bought some pot while out hunting, they wouldn't even try to apply the 5-year mandatory minimum in that case because they'd say to themselves, well, I don't think that's what Congress had in mind. I'm not even going to bring that up. I don't think this person deserves 5 years for this relatively minor drug transaction, even though technically the law applies. Now, that would be, I would think, most of us would agree, a positive exercise of prosecutorial discretion. But what the Sentencing Commission has documented, what others have documented, is over a long pattern, prosecutors end up subject to the same kinds of biases and a consideration of inappropriate factors. Generally, white upper middle class defendants will get the benefits of prosecutorial discretion, especially if, and this is the last part of the system that's gotten justifiable focus, especially if those defendants will cooperate with the prosecutors to help them make other cases. So one of the settings in which prosecutorial discretion has been at its height and that these mandatory sentencing schemes have had problems is not only do they put more power in the hands of prosecutors to decide whether or not to charge some of these more severe sentencing rules, but they can and often will go to defendants and their attorneys and say, look, it's very simple. I can prosecute you on these facts and you'll be facing at least 10 years and the judge will have no power to do anything about that unless you agree to cooperate with me, perhaps be an informant, perhaps snitch on all the other folks, and then I won't charge that offense and you'll only be facing a couple years. And the problem there is twofold. One, it puts extraordinary pressure on the defendant to give up his right to go to trial, to give up other rights in order to reduce his sentencing exposure. But it also creates the opportunity for even more perverse mischief in that defendants who may not have any good evidence on anybody else might be incentivized to make up evidence, to point the finger at people who aren't guilty in an effort to try to make a deal with prosecutors and avoid being subject to the full brunt of the prosecutorial threat there. And the increasing evidence of wrongful convictions, I think, need to be filtered through these concerns because it can create particular pressure on defendants to plead guilty, maybe where they themselves are not guilty, and to point their fingers at others, not because the others have obviously done it, but because they have such a strong incentive to try to reduce their sentencing exposure.
Yeah. We're a little bit past our midpoint here. We have some other callers we will get to, but before I do that, just for the benefit of anyone who's just tuned in, let me introduce again our guest, Douglas Berman. He's professor of law at The Ohio State University. His main interests are criminal law and criminal sentencing. He's co-authored a case book, Sentencing Law and Policy, Cases, Statutes, and Guidelines. He's also written on a lot of other subjects for many publications, everything from capital punishment to federal sentencing guidelines. He's editor of the Federal Sentencing Reporter. He has served on that for more than a decade. He's also co-managing editor of the Ohio State Journal of Criminal Law. And in addition to that, he's the creator of a widely read blog called Sentencing Law and Policy, which, as I mentioned here a couple times, has the distinction of being the first blog ever cited by the U.S. Supreme Court. We're talking in this hour about various complexities involving sentencing law and policy, and questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners, and we do have that toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that, 800-222-9455. Other callers here. We'll go next in line to someone in Urbana. This is line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
One thing that's puzzled me about these mandatory sentencing laws is that first off, why the judiciary itself isn't rebelling against them in that if I was a judge, I would consider having my hands tied in this fashion being an excessive overreach of the legislative branch into the judicial branch. That'd be one point. And related to that, the results of many of these, the practical results of many of these mandatory sentencing laws, I've wondered why they haven't been cited as violations of whatever amendment it is that has to do with cruel and unusual punishment, where some schmuck who gets caught with some crack cocaine will be sentenced to a longer prison term. Or sent to a prison, say, and because the prison is overcrowded, someone who has committed a violent crime, a person we definitely don't want out on the street if they're nasty and, cause rape, mayhem, and so on and so forth, they're let out early to make room for this party that, in my mind, is a somewhat lesser threat to my personal safety than the former is, and why that sort of thing hasn't been tested constitutionally and so forth. So if you could speak to that.
Absolutely. And those are terrific questions, and I can give you a little bit of the backstory. In fact, especially when the federal sentencing guidelines went into place, judges, in fact, did rebel, although they rebelled in a way that ended up proving not particularly effective. One of the interesting stories is when the federal sentencing system became mandatory and went into place, more than half of the district judges in charge of applying the new rules declared them unconstitutional. The theories of unconstitutionality range from separation of powers, that they couldn't have their hands tied that way, to unlawful delegation from Congress to the Sentencing Commission that wrote these elaborate rules. Those cases ultimately made their way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court blessed the new system in a case called Mistretta. And so the initial wave of rebellion from the lower courts got tamped down. And I've actually written, unfortunately, I think judges at the lower court levels were overly pushed back from that one Supreme Court holding and then became resistant to a range of other constitutional claims. The conclusion in the lower courts was the Supreme Court said this was okay, and so we're going to follow that. The same story is more or less in place with respect to the Eighth Amendment and the cruel and unusual punishment claims. There have been cases in the modern era of mandatory sentencing laws, the most famous pair being state cases from Michigan, a case called Harmelin, where a first-time drug dealer got a life sentence. And the Supreme Court ultimately upheld that as constitutional, citing deference to legislatures and federalism and suggesting that federal courts shouldn't use the Constitution to, in a sense, micromanage the sentencing choices of states. Similarly, in California, in a case called Ewing that related to California's really draconian three-strikes law, the court upheld a 25-year-to-life sentence for a fellow who had stolen three golf clubs because it was his third strike. And the problem has been, I think, as different lower court judges have sought to rebel and have sought to bring, in my view, a little bit more balance and sanity to the system, historically the Supreme Court's been quite resistant and has shut down those challenges. That's taken a little turn in just the last few years. It's a complicated legal story, but in 2005, what finally hit pay dirt for the judges was a decision by the Supreme Court in a case called Booker that said there was a procedural problem with the way that the mandatory sentencing laws were being applied, a Sixth Amendment problem, a right to jury concern, because judges were doing all this fact-finding. And as a remedy to that, the Supreme Court declared the federal guidelines advisory rather than mandatory. And many judges have been engaged in what might be called a quiet rebellion since then. Many more judges are going below the guidelines in these kinds of cases when they're allowed to under this new Booker ruling. In addition, and this is one case that's worth keeping an eye on for at least law fans, but I think even the general public should notice this and pay attention, the Supreme Court has heard an argument in a case from Florida, this time involving juvenile offenders given life sentences. And there's considerable buzz, and in my case, hope, that the Supreme Court will swing the pendulum back, not be quite so deferential to the decision by states to really throw the book at certain types of offenders and will give the Eighth Amendment concern that this caller emphasized a little bit more life. And if they provide that signal, there's no doubt that lower courts are going to feel more emboldened to consider some of the constitutional arguments that you were suggesting.
I have another caller here and I want to get to. Also, I want to come back to Booker because I think this is really interesting to the extent that I understand it, that it puts some really interesting wrinkles into the whole thing. But let me say that for a second.
Sure.
I don't want to make this other caller wait. So let's go to line one in Champaign. Hello.
Yes. It's a very, very interesting program. This clampdown in sentencing, I know you talked a little bit about historical context earlier. As I think most Americans know, we have, from what I understand, the larger percentage of people who are either in prison or on parole than almost any other country in the world.
That's right.
With 2%, I think, of the entire population. And, of course, the financial costs are obviously astounding as a result. Speaking simply in terms of economics, leaving aside the issues of justice, questions of justice. But I'm wondering, in terms of this, the roots of this, do you primarily see this as a kind of politicization of sentencing from, let's say, the 80s onwards especially? I'm just wondering how you see the origins and development of this shift in sentencing. Is it related primarily, I think you may have suggested this, but let's say violence in society, increasing violence, or the proliferation of guns, for example?
Well, I think there's a host of factors, but I think you put your finger on the idea of the politicization of these issues. And one might even say, and some have argued, it's also the democratization of some of these matters. And in particular, when we went back to the rehabilitative era, there was very much a sense that experts knew best, right? Whether we were talking about psychological experts, whether we were talking about legal experts, whether we were talking about corrections experts across the board, we could trust, the thought was, the judges, the parole officials, the correction officials, to make good judgments about who is or isn't a threat to society. And one of the factors that was part of this politicization was we shouldn't trust the judges. I mean, as you probably know, throughout the politics, beating up on judges
right.
On a variety of issues has been popular, and this has been one that particularly the right has made much of. We can't
right.
trust those liberal, soft-on-crime judges.
Right.
And so we need to put restrictions on what they do, and that has been combined with, I think, a decline in even a faith in expertise. So as an example I mentioned earlier, the Sentencing Commission, which is the studied body that looks at all these statistics, has recommended for over a decade the elimination of this 100-to-1 crack powder ratio. And when they first went forward with a massive report to Congress saying, you know, something needs to be done here, it has this profoundly negative effect both on justice and public safety, Congress, that time a Democratic Congress, actually it was Republican Congress, but with Bill Clinton in the White House, so a Democratic executive branch that signed off on this, rejected the commission's proposal. They said, well, we know best. We had the right idea when we said crack is more serious than powder. Don't give us all those statistics and all these recommendations that we should equalize it. And so I think that's been, as much as it is any one factor, whether it's guns or drugs, I mean, there's so many factors that relate to crime rates. But when we're looking at sentencing laws, very much the instinct that this is something that politicians should be doing rather than experts, and that this is a matter that the public not only should have an opinion on, but that their opinion should be given voice in the law. That has been sort of the turn over the last few decades. And part of that story, of course, is the prisoner population, the offenders, are going to be the least sympathetic individuals across the board. And so, you know, and this has been part of also the Democratic mindset as well, ever since the 88 election when Dukakis' softness and the Willie Horton issue
right.
seemed to really do in his campaign. Bill Clinton made a very conscious and very, you might say, strategically effective choice to not let anyone seem tougher than him on crime. And so the 92 election is in some sense even more famous for the fact that Clinton went out of his way to be tough on crime, to talk tough on crime. He, among other things, took a break from his campaigning to go preside over an execution of a mentally retarded individual in Arkansas. And not only has that kind of broken the dam, right? There's no longer a party that is very resistant to the sort of tough on crime politicking and rhetoricking. But in addition, that has become sort of the modern DNA of successful Democrats, right? Don't let the crime issue sort of get behind you. And we even saw this to some extent in the Obama administration. One of the inside stories about the decision to nominate Sonia Sotomayor for President Obama's first judicial appointment to the Supreme Court was that she had served time as a prosecutor, right? And even though she may end up being more liberal on crime and justice issues than we might predict by that, in fact, President Obama's judicial appointments to lower courts, their most common element is former time as a prosecutor. And again, I have extraordinary respect for prosecutors, but the fact that those are the sort of backgrounds of the individuals that even a Democratic administration is putting into the judiciary suggests to me that, again, we have both parties that are almost sort of scared of their shadow when it comes to these issues. And the last part of this, and you can see how this plays out, even when a Republican takes a different path. I'm thinking here now of Mike Huckabee's recent controversy over the commutation he showed to Maurice Clemens that ended up leading to a terrible crime. You know, how quick people are to pounce on that and say, well, his career is over. You know, that one moment of leniency, which I, to his credit, I think Mr. Huckabee has tried to defend on its terms quite righteously. You know, if any of these folks, after there's been a moment of softness, goes on to commit another crime, and we know just as a statistical matter, that if you grant enough clemencies or you cut enough breaks, somebody's going to not, you know, stay on the straight and narrow, that could end up dooming a political career. And I'll bring this back to an issue I'm working on right now. Much to my dismay, President Obama has not granted a single clemency during his year in the presidency. And, you know, he certainly hasn't been a shrinking violet on lots of other topics. And he actually is now only in company with a few other modern presidents in not granting some pardons or some clemencies during the first year of his administration. And I've written on my website that I wish this is one of those settings where he would act more like Lincoln. Lincoln, who obviously had a lot of things going on during his presidency, granted on average two pardons or clemencies per week because he understood the need for balance in the operation of the federal criminal justice system. But that hasn't. It's been politicized, as you say, and I emphasize these points because I think there's a tendency to say, well, if my political party was in charge, I'm sure we'd do a better job. And I've been quite pessimistic because these trends have played out over the last 20 years, no matter which political party is got the reins of either Congress or the executive branch.
Yeah, and I actually think that one thing I wanted to suggest is I think it may have a lot to do with the development of desegregation, busing, and so forth in the background of this, Willie Horton, of course, aside, that someone like Obama, he's, of course, being African-American, is all the more hesitant than to take any kind of action in this regard, which is really pathetic and sad. But I think it may reflect that, you know, it's not that we're actually a more violent society than other societies, but we're a more angry society.
I think that's certainly right, and you're particularly shrewd to put your finger on the connections, sometimes understated, sometimes overstated, between racial conflict and criminal justice issues. And in fact, one of my colleagues here at Ohio State, a woman named Michelle Alexander, has a new book coming out called The New Jim Crow. And the background of that book is that the move towards mass incarceration, she analogizes it to the Jim Crow laws after slavery, because in fact we do see not only a disproportionate number of African Americans in the criminal justice system, but over time we've also seen a range of civil disabilities attached to having that status as a criminal. So the most profound example of this is felon disenfranchisement. That, you know, in many states, not all of them, but in many states, not only can a person not vote while they're incarcerated, but even once they're released, once they've gone back to the straight and narrow, they remain permanently disenfranchised, permanently ineligible to vote, simply by virtue of that felony. And my colleague's point is, you know, talk about a profound way to prevent African-American communities from having their say in the political process when you say that we'll call them felons, we'll disproportionately prosecute them through a variety of means, and then once they're out, they're not even eligible to vote. That has, I think, a profound social reality to play in these stories, and it's something that I think you know, anybody who is trying to take stock of all the reasons why we've gotten to where we are has to be attentive to that racial and social history.
Yeah, certainly, and I think the anger over race and the issues of poverty, the association of certain groups with poverty has also worked very much against those who are dispossessed more generally, and, of course, groups like ACORN and so forth. But anyway, thank you very much.
Sure, very well. And I'll just add one little point to that, too, which is it's not just the story of the way in which our formal criminal laws get applied, but it's also the way some other data that we have that are well-established get framed. So the most profound example here being there is little doubt that providing adequate health care and providing adequate schooling reduces the crime rates because criminogenically we just have all sorts of data that the vast majority of people who commit serious crimes are folks that either have mental or substance abuse difficulties, and the vast majority of folks who commit crimes are folks who did not get through high school and certainly didn't have a chance to go through college. So one could imagine a society that would say we need to do health care reform, we need to do education reform because it will keep us safer. And yet we don't hear that kind of framing of these issues, again, in part because there is a belief that if we articulate it that way, these racial dynamics, these social dynamics come into play, and people say, well, yeah, it makes us safer, but those benefits end up going to the dispossessed. Those benefits go to socially marginalized groups, and that's not a way to build a popular majority that seems to be needed in a system that is now so democratically and for good reason, democratically attentive.
Mm. About 6-7 minutes left in this part of the show. Our guest is Douglas Berman. He's professor of law at The Ohio State University. Now I know this is complicated, but I wanted to come back to the Supreme Court decision that you touched on a little bit earlier in the conversation, U.S. v. Booker. We were talking earlier about the fact that even though we have now sentencing guidelines that the judges have to take into consideration a number of factors about the crime and about the individual as they're calculating the sentence. So it is kind of complicated. It seemed to me, as I understand it, what the court was saying in Booker, it was saying now, if you judge, you can't take into consideration anything as you're calculating your sentence that the jury didn't hear about. Because if you do that, then that's, you know, that violates the Sixth Amendment. So then, but and then so that sort of tossed the whole thing up in the air. If the judge was looking at various aspects of the person, of their background, of the crime that were not introduced at trial.
Right, right, and it's even more complicated than that. But the basic story is the federal system evolved so that the rules that were in place for sentencing were very focused on the offense, the nature of the crime, and in fact required the judge to make a number of findings in order to calculate a sentencing range that seemed an awful lot like what we would think a jury ought to be doing. So that, again, using sort of a simple drug case as the best example here, the federal guidelines, even if the defendant had just pled guilty to a case of simple drug distribution, the federal guidelines would then tell the judge, well, you need to calculate how much drugs were involved in the overall offense. And they even prescribe to look at the entire course of conduct. So even if the defendant had only pled guilty to distributing drugs, say, on December 10th, the judge was told by these sentencing rules, well, look if that was part of a course of conduct where he sold drugs the week before and sold drugs the week after, and the prosecutors often would come in alleging this person was part of a vast conspiracy, and here are all the evidence we have that shows not only was he dealing drugs, but he also had guns involved, and he also beat up a little old lady one time. And we want you, judge, even though this defendant has only pled guilty to drug distribution on one date, we want you to, judge, and the sentencing rules said for the judge to find all these additional facts to justify his sentence being much longer. And a number of defendants in a variety of ways had complained about that, but that had never gotten much traction in lower courts. But for a variety of reasons that are complicated, the Supreme Court ultimately, in what was a very interesting coalition of what are seemed thought to be the more right-leaning justices, Justice Thomas and Scalia, with some of the more left-leaning justices, Justice Stevens, Ginsburg, and former Justice Souter, got together and said, first in a case called Blakely, which was in 2004, that it's a problem when either the states or the feds call upon judges to find all these facts that aren't fundamentally part of the crime that the defendant either pled guilty to or that a jury has found. And they struck it down as a matter of Sixth Amendment, the amendment that calls for the right to a jury trial. And then the question became for the federal system, well, okay, now that you've said this system with all of this judicial fact-finding is unconstitutional, what do we do? And there was a big debate. Some people said, well, we should just run those same rules, keep them mandatory, but then require the prosecutor to prove up all these facts in front of a jury. Ultimately, what the Supreme Court said was, well, we're not sure that's what Congress would have wanted. We'll instead make the system advisory. No longer are judges' hands to be formally tied by all of those sentencing calculations. And they've created something of a hybrid system, which has, again, kept me in a job. It was the Booker decision in which my blog was cited, because figuring out what kind of compromise we're going to have here, and the lower courts have struggled with this mightily. The Supreme Court has essentially said, you still have to make all those fact findings, judge. You still have to calculate the sentence under this big book of rules. But then once you get to the end and it calls for a sentence of, say, you know, 4 to 5 years, you now have not quite unlimited discretion, but pretty unlimited discretion to impose a different sentence that in some cases can be higher or lower, based on your own sense of the policies that Congress put in place for the overall sentencing system. And again, as this gets us back to where we started, some of the complaints have been that we're seeing an increase in disparity now, as judges have more and more authority to let their own visions of justice influence whether or not they will follow this big book of rules, which they're still required to pay attention to, but are no longer required to follow because of this Booker ruling.
Yeah, would you just real quickly, I guess in about a minute, I would think that maybe for some people the concern would be that somehow they would think the judges were being too lax. Is there in fact a problem that goes the other way, that judges are actually maybe being on their own accord for their own reasons are actually being more severe. That is, they're going above what is the sentencing range that's suggested.
Oh, well, absolutely. And in fact, this is where the federal system is so dynamic. They say all politics is local. All sentencing is local, too. Yeah. There are folks in more liberal regions of the country who are ecstatic as defense attorneys that judges have more discretion. Disproportionately, it's the prosecutors who are ecstatic in more conservative areas because the judges there are more likely to be leaning harsher rather than more lenient with their new authority.
So again, I feel I'm at the point where I often, so I'm at the end of so many programs where I really want to say to the host, so for your average person, what about this is really important? What do you want people to take away from
that conversation? What I'd really like people to think about is the extraordinary costs that both having this elaborate systems creates for the justice system. So we have an extraordinary amount of time and energy, lawyers, prosecutors, judges, doing calculations that may not be the game worth the candle. And so that's one thing that's this balance between complexity and rules and judgment. But that's an endemic problem to all the law. The concern with mass incarceration that was discussed before is the economic cost of the tough-on-crime attitudes that have accompanied this move to structured sentencing. And for me, and this is how I explain it to my wife, who always wonders why I'm so worried about a bunch of criminals, the cost is not just one borne by taxpayers in general. We're seeing cuts to social services across the board, including education. And that's ultimately, I think, a harmful approach to public safety, California being the most extreme example here, where their crime rates aren't declining, even as their prison rates increase, in part because the cuts to social services, the cuts to education, the other cuts that in fact end up being more criminogenic. The description here is we're trying to suture people up at the back end rather than trying to prevent the harms in the first instance. And I think that's something that whether or not you pay a lot of attention to crime and justice issues is something that every citizen needs to be attentive to.
Our guest, Douglas Berman, is professor of law at The Ohio State University. You want to read more of his thinking on some of these issues, you can take a look at his blog, Sentencing Law and Policy. Professor Berman, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate you devoting the time to this topic, David.